The lesson I'd like to give tonight is on the topic of holiness. And I remember a few years back when I was still worshiping in New York, Dave Hamlett was worshiping with us at the time, that he gave an excellent lesson on holiness. And I don't have that great of a memory, and over the years I've forgotten most of what he said in that lesson, but I remember the impact that it had on me, and walking away from that lesson thinking, wow, that is such an awesome responsibility when God says that you are to be holy as I am holy. And so I'd like to look at this. I don't have a copy of his lesson, so this is my own, and I'm sure it won't be up to the quality that I remember from that lesson, but I hope that you can gain a fraction of what I gained from that in understanding holiness as God defines it. If you look up the word holy or holiness, the definition would be sacred or consecrated or dedicated, which is a little bit different than what we often think about, or at least what the world thinks about as far as holiness. Many times people almost have this idea of kind of something being holy is almost magical, you know, where it's just kind of a different idea than what holiness really is. And I didn't find the word set apart in the dictionary like I was expecting, but God actually defines holiness in that way. And we can see that in Leviticus chapter 20. And I'm going to be spending most of my time between Exodus and Leviticus, so if you want to turn there, we're not going to be doing a ton of page turning. But in Leviticus chapter 20, verses 22 through 26, we can see how God defines it. Leviticus chapter 20, starting in verse 22, says, "You are therefore to keep all my statutes and all my ordinances and do them, so that the land to which I am bringing you to live will not spew you out. Moreover, you shall not follow the customs of the nation, which I shall drive out before you, for they did all these things, and therefore I have abhorred them. Hence, I have said to you, you are to possess their land, and I myself will give it to you to possess it, a land flowing with milk and honey. I am the Lord your God who has separated you from the peoples. You are therefore to make a distinction between the clean animal and the unclean, and between the unclean bird and the clean. And you shall not make yourselves detestable by animal or by bird or by anything that creeps on the ground, which I have separated for you as unclean. Thus you are to be holy to me, for I, the Lord, am holy, and I have set you apart from the peoples to be mine." Here God clearly defines holiness as being set apart. God, when he chose Israel, he set them apart from anyone else. They were not to be like the other nations. In fact, he tells them that that also applies to how they are to live. Because he says, even though I'm giving this land to you, you are not to act like those other people. You are, how did he put it in verse 23? "You shall not follow the customs of the nation which I shall drive out before you." And so holiness is not just a separation, but being completely different from everyone else. And so we see both the word separated and set apart as good words to define holiness. You'll also notice that in the middle of this, there's a little bit of responsibility that God expects from his people who are to be holy. Things like how he starts out, "You must keep my statutes and ordinances. As I said before, don't follow the customs of the other nations. And you're not to make yourself unclean or unholy. You are to keep..." If God says, "I'm setting you apart, I'm making you holy, and you're to stay that way. You are to determine what is clean and what is unclean based on what I tell you, and keep it that way." So I'd like to separate my lesson into two parts. At first, I want to look at some things that God set as holy, what should be holy. And then after we look at some passages there, I'd like to look at some examples of holiness that we actually see in the Bible. Turn back to Exodus chapter 28. Exodus chapter 28, verses 36 through 38. Exodus 28, starting in verse 36. It says, "You shall also make a plate of pure gold and shall engrave on it, like the engravings of a seal, holy to the Lord. And you shall fasten it on a blue cord, and it shall be on the turban. It shall be at the front of the turban. And it shall be on Aaron's forehead. And Aaron shall take away the iniquity of the holy things which the sons of Israel consecrate with regard to all their holy gifts. And it shall always be on his forehead, that they may be accepted before the Lord." This was something kind of cool that I didn't remember reading about in the past. Obviously, this is talking about the priests, how the priests were to be holy. And that's probably one of the first things that you think of when you're trying to go through the list of what would be holy. But I didn't remember this thing that God had them do, this little instruction where he, if you go and read through this whole chapter, it's just list after list of all of these details and things they were supposed to do. But this one particular one we read in these few verses was that they were to take a gold plate and they were to engrave on it, holy to the Lord. And it, this gold plate gets attached to the turban, which goes on the priest's head. So when the priest is walking around, it's got this big sign on this front that's engraved in gold that says, "Holy to the Lord." So just in case you didn't recognize this was a priest, he's got this just as a constant reminder that he is holy and set apart to serve God. And it also says there, the last verse we read, it's always on his forehead. This isn't just something that he just put on for a minute or something and then for a ceremony and then took off and it sat around the rest of the time. It was something that he always had on him, it seems. If you look up earlier in the chapter, like I said, most of this chapter is going through all the details of what the priests were to wear and such. And we can see even the priest's clothing was to be considered holy. Look in verses 2 and 3. It says, "And you shall make holy garments for Aaron your brother, for glory and for beauty. And you shall speak to all the skillful persons who I have endowed with the spirit of wisdom, that they make Aaron's garments to consecrate him, that he may minister as a priest to me." And so even the clothing that the priests were to wear were considered holy to God. We could read other passages where even some instruments that they used were holy. There's lots of verses about that, but one other thing I wanted to point out here is that in verse 2, we see the word holy there. In verse 3, near the end of the verse, it says, "The garments are to consecrate him." That's actually a very similar word. If you've looked up like the Greek or the Hebrew words in Strong's before, I don't know any Greek or Hebrew, but I know that sometimes they'll have slight variations of a word. And I didn't write it down because I was planning on having my iPad in front of me, but it's kind of like saying, love versus lovely. It's just a slightly different form of the same word. And so the word consecrate is actually just a slightly different form of that word holy. His garments were to consecrate him, to make him holy. These were to set him apart so that when the people were looking at him doing his duty, they would recognize this is a priest. He is set apart to serve God. Let's look back a couple more chapters to Exodus chapter 19. Exodus chapter 19, verses 5 through 6. It says, "Now then, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my commandment, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the sons of Israel." And so here we can see that God is calling his people a kingdom of priests or a holy nation. Here he's showing that all of his people are to be a holy people. It's not just the priests, but everyone that he called is going to be holy. Now, I've often kind of ran over that phrase, a kingdom of priests. And usually you focus on the word priest and you think, yeah, they had priests, they were all priests, and you kind of move on. But I got to thinking, that's actually kind of if you're thinking of holiness as being set apart and different, how would you apply it to that phrase? How would the Israelites be different being a kingdom of priests? What are most other nations going to be a kingdom of? Most other nations are going to be, want to have a kingdom of warriors, right? Your job is, as a kingdom, you want to be the most powerful, you want to conquer other people. And so, while other nations are striving to have the most powerful army and be known as the kingdom with warriors, God's people are to be known as a kingdom of priests. Both would be dealing with blood and have blood on their hands, but for very different reasons. Instead of conquering and killing other people for selfish reasons to take over their territory, God's priests would be killing animals in order to make atonement for their sins. Let's look a few chapters ahead in Exodus. Turn to Exodus chapter 26. Exodus chapter 26 and verse 33. You shall hang up the veil under the clasp, and it shall bring in the ark of the testimony there within the veil. And the veil shall serve for you as a partition between the holy place and the holy of holies. And you shall put the mercy seat on the ark of the testimony in the holy of holies. The point I wanted to make here is we've seen so far the priests were holy, even the priest's garments were holy. All of the Israelites in general were a kingdom of priests. They were to be holy as God's chosen people. But now we see there's actually a holy place, not a person or a thing, but this place, this section of this area was to be considered holy. And there were actually two. There, inside the temple, there was the holy place, which the priests would go in and out of all the time, but not the regular people. And then there was the most holy place, which only one high priest got to go into once a year. And so there were separations between, it wasn't just everything in one holy bucket and everything not. Here there were multiple levels of holiness. And the veil that we read about here was like the partition that was separating the holy and the most holy. Something else that I was reminded of when I was reading this was I was thinking of other places that were holy, and the first one that I found wasn't actually the one that I was looking for. The verse that I found is over in Joshua chapter 5 and verse 15. And if you want to turn there for a minute, this was another one of those places where I found something I wasn't expecting or didn't remember. Joshua chapter 5, verse 15 says, "And the captain of the Lord's host said to Joshua, 'Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy.' And Joshua did so." And I went, wait a minute, that says Joshua, it should say Moses. And then I realized that there are actually two instances where this happened. The wording is almost identical. But just as Moses was told by God to remove his sandals for the place where he's standing was holy ground at the beginning when God called him, the same exact thing happened to Joshua here. And this was actually, it appears from what we read, it seems like it was an angel. If you read the context, the verses before it, Joshua kind of goes out and sees this guy that's standing with a sword. This is right before they're about to take Jericho, and he asks them, whose side are you on? Are you on their side or our side? And he says, I'm on God's side. And Joshua realizes that he's an angel, or at least a spokesperson for God. And this is where, right immediately following this, when the angel tells him the place he's standing is holy ground, is when he gives him the instructions on how he's supposed to take over Jericho. But again, there were apparently holy places. The most common we know is the holy place inside the temple, but God set up under other circumstances, places that were holy, because he was there, it seems. Let's also look at Exodus chapter 20. And this is the last verse I have as far as what should be considered holy, and the most important, because obviously God is holy. But something that you may not realize when you're reading the Ten Commandments is that I think most people realize that the first four apply to our relationship with God. Drawing a blank. You shall have no other gods before me, no graven images or idols, don't take his name in vain, remember the Sabbath and keep it holy. The first four apply to God, and the other six apply to our fellow man. But as I was going through them, I realized that each of those first four, which apply to our relationship with God, also involve holiness. If you think about it, the first one, have no other gods before me. What is God doing? He is setting himself apart from any other god that man might try to worship. He's making that distinction and separating himself from any other possible god. In that case, he's making himself holy. His second commandment is to have no other idols. God is separating himself from his creation, because what is an idol? It's just a piece of wood or precious metal or whatever they chose to create into some kind of image. And God is saying, no, I created that. I am separate from that creation that I made. He is making himself holy. The third commandment, God says not to use his name in vain. God is showing that his name is special. His name is holy. And that we are to keep his name holy by not treating it like any other name out there, but to treat it as special. And he is making his name holy. Speaking of which, some of you may be aware that the Jews have, in the past, have gone to an extreme where they actually don't use God's name except under very certain circumstances. I can't remember what they are. I think it's when they're actually reading from God's word, but they wouldn't just use it in regular conversation, or possibly in prayers, I think, if I remember right. But even just if you were having a conversation about God in an email or something, I think a lot of times they would write, you know, G-D, or I guess if you're writing in a different language, it would be different, but they wouldn't completely spell it out because they've gone to such an extreme to not use God's name in vain, to only use it in certain circumstances and in that way to make God's name holy. And while I don't think we need to go to that extreme that they did, it's also important to realize that there's more to this than just not using God's name as a swear word or something like that. That's generally what we think of, and obviously that's wrong, and we can't do that. But I think we should realize that God's name is holy, and we should be very careful about how we do use his name when we choose to use it. And then finally, the fourth commandment that God gives dealing with man and God is to keep the Sabbath day holy. And there God is specifically setting apart that seventh day for the Jews and telling them that that was to be holy. And when you think of it, God didn't even have to tell them that the Sabbath day was holy, because he made it holy when he created the earth. Just in the difference of the seventh day, when you see that God worked on days 1 through 6, and day 7 was set apart, it was completely different because he did no work. So God made it holy just by definition of doing something completely different on that seventh day. And so he tells them that the seventh day is to be holy. It's completely different, and in fact almost the opposite of the other days. So hopefully that is, helps you to understand what is holy and how God defines it. I'd like to look now at a few examples of holiness that we can find. Turn to Leviticus chapter 10. This is something we're very familiar with, a very familiar story to most of us. And it wasn't one I was expecting to include in my lesson when I started preparing it, but it's actually very important. Leviticus chapter 10, I'll just read the first three verses. Now Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, took their respective fire pans, and after putting fire in them, placed incense on it, and offered strange fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. And fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord. Then Moses said to Aaron, "It is what the Lord spoke, saying, by those who come near me, I will be treated as holy, and before all the people, I will be honored." So Aaron, therefore, kept silent. The problem here was that Nadab and Abihu did not treat God as holy. Usually, if I hadn't read this recently and you just asked me, you know, some day randomly out of the blue why God killed Nadab and Abihu, I probably would have said because they offered strange fire. And while that's what they did, the reason for killing them wasn't necessarily the strange fire. It was because God commanded them to do their worship in a particular way. And they decided to change that. They decided to do it their own way, just slightly different. Probably thinking that God doesn't mind. We don't have all the details. We don't know what was running through their mind. Maybe they had something that seemed logical to them. As humans, we can be very good at rationalizing things. Just a little bit of incense that I'm throwing in this fire. It'll smell good to God. It seems like something that he would like. But it was not what God demanded. And God was not going to tolerate it because he needed to keep himself holy. And in order to do that, he needed to punish those who were not treating him that way, who were not recognizing that God is different than everyone else. And although your earthly father may cut you some slack and say, okay, I told you to do this with fire and I didn't say not to do it with incense, God expects more of us. He expects us to treat him differently. And he did not get that from Nadab and Abihu. When we read this, we may think, wow, that seems awfully harsh. And yes, it is harsh. But God needed to do this in order to keep his holiness intact. And that this also reminded me of the story of Uzzah. When we often read about Uzzah, how he saw the cart was, the ark was about to slip off the cart, and he reached out his hand to stop it. He was doing a good thing, it seemed. He was trying to help. You know, you might even think you might have done the same thing if you were in his shoes. And God just struck him dead, and you think, wow, that's harsh. But God told them what to do, and they didn't do it. They didn't follow it to a T like he instructed them. And so he had to punish them to keep himself holy. Turn ahead a little bit to Numbers chapter 20. Numbers chapter 20. And I'm going to read the first 13 verses here of Numbers 20. It says, "Then the sons of Israel, the whole congregation, came to the wilderness of Zin in the first month, and the people stayed at Kadesh. Now Miriam died there and was buried there. And there was no water for the congregation, and they assembled themselves against Moses and Aaron. The people thus contended with Moses and spoke, saying, 'If we had only perished when our brothers perished before the Lord, why then have you brought the Lord's assembly into this wilderness for us and our beasts to die here? And why have you made us come up from Egypt to bring us into this wretched place?' It is not a place of grain or figs or vines or pomegranates, nor is there any water to drink. You can almost hear them whining as they're saying this. Then Moses and Aaron came in from the presence of the assembly to the doorway of the tent of meeting and fell on their faces. Then the glory of the Lord appeared to them, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Take the rod, and you and your brother Aaron assemble the congregation and speak to the rock before their eyes, that it may yield its water. You shall thus bring forth water for them out of the rock, and let the congregation and there be strength." So Moses took the rod from before the Lord, just as he had commanded him. And Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly before the rock. And he said to them, "Listen now, you rebels, shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock?" Then Moses lifted up his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod, and water came forth abundantly in the congregation and their beast strength. But the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "Because you have not believed me to treat me as holy in the sight of the sons of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them." Those were the waters of Meribah, because the sons of Israel contended with the Lord, and he proved himself holy among them. Another passage that we're very familiar with. Moses does 99% of what God asked him to. Actually, he did 101%. He did everything God asked him to do. He grabbed the rod just like God told him. Even though God didn't say to do anything with the rod, he said, "Bring it with you." He told him to gather the assembly together. He told him to speak to the rock. He got all that right. He just added one little extra detail where he used the rod to hit the rock. But then there was also one other little thing that he did where he said, "Must we bring forth this water?" I'm not really sure if it was a combination of both or if it was just what he said, because when you look at the previous example with Nadab and Abihu, they didn't say anything, they just added something, kind of like Moses adding in the hitting the stone there. But it seems like even if that wasn't enough, Moses also says, "Must we bring forth this water?" He's elevating himself. I'm sure he realized that if anybody asked him, he'd say, "Yeah, it's God that's doing the work. He's bringing forth the water. I'm just his instrument, you know, hitting this rock and it's coming out." But he elevated himself. He didn't set God apart. He didn't treat God as holy like he should have. And God calls him out on that. You see, at the very end there, it says, at the end of verse 13, "He proved himself holy among them." By doing this, by punishing Moses, he was proving himself to be holy. Because if he didn't, then he would be telling them one thing, like a father who says one thing and then doesn't hold up. You know, he says, "I'm going to spank you," and then he doesn't do it. God had to do this in order to keep his holiness intact. Again, this seems very harsh, and yet this is the way it is. This is what holiness is. God is to be set apart like no other, and he is to be treated that way. I'd like to look next at Isaiah chapter 6. We're going to leave Exodus and Leviticus. We just have a few verses left. Isaiah chapter 6. And I'm going to read the first 7 verses. It says, "In the year of King Uzziah's death, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, lofty and exalted, with the train of his robe filling the temple. Seraphim stood above him, each having 6 wings. With 2 he covered his face, with 2 he covered his feet, and with 2 he flew. And one called out to another and said, 'Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory.' And the foundations of the thresholds trembled at the voice of him who called out while the temple was filling with smoke. Then he said, "Woe is me, for I am ruined, because I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." Then one of the seraphim flew to me with a burning coal in his hand, which he had taken from the altar with tongs. And he touched my mouth with it and said, "Behold, this has touched your lips, and your iniquity is taken away, and your sin is forgiven." We have a near identical version of this vision recorded in Revelation with more detail. And when we read about it, we can see just how great and awesome this picture is of God. And it's so impressive when Isaiah is before God that he doesn't consider himself worthy to be there. And if you think of Israel at the time, out of all of the people in Israel, who would be the most qualified to be in God's presence out of any of them? Wouldn't it be the prophet Isaiah? It seems unlikely that there would be anyone in Israel, or even on the earth. Well, I don't know, it's hard to say, but if anybody's qualified to be in God's presence, you would think that it would be this man. And yet you see his response when he's in God's presence. He says, "Woe is me, for I am ruined, because I am a man of unclean lips, and the people around me are people of unclean lips." We are very close to God as Christians because we realize under the New Testament that how close we can be to God. We can speak to him through prayer anytime we want. We can call him Father. And yet, when there are times like this or any other time in the Bible where we read of people that actually found themselves in God's presence, the answer is always the same as this: "Woe is me, for I am undone," or "I am ruined." And you'll also notice that God didn't just leave him that way. He did something. Isaiah's problem was saying that I'm a man of unclean lips. But God, through this seraphim that came over with the coal, touched his mouth and he cleansed him. So instead of being a man of unclean lips, God cleansed him so that his lips were clean, so that he could stand there before God. And that was necessary in order for Isaiah to be fit for service. God cleansed him, and then if you keep reading, God says, "Hey, I got a job for somebody. Who's going to go?" And Isaiah says, "Hey, here I am, send me." So it seems that although God does require us to be holy, we need to be holy so that we can serve him, because until we are holy and cleansed, we're not fit for service. We're not fit to be in his presence. And that brings me to the New Testament in Romans chapter 12, another verse which many of us are familiar with. Romans chapter 12, verse 1 says, "I urge you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect." God expects something of us, just as he expected something of the Israelites. And he doesn't just cleanse us and make us holy so that we can sit around and just, you know, sit there and watch him in his holy temple. He expects us to serve him. And just as the priests offered those sacrifices year after year, we are to also offer sacrifices, just not with animals anymore. We are told here we are to be living sacrifices. We are to make ourselves a sacrifice, to give up what we want, to do what God wants. You know, I recently found out about this cool website. You can find it just by searching for bull and goats calculator. But all you do is you put in your birthday, and it calculates how many bulls and goats and rams and lambs you would have had to offer by now based on when you were born. And so for me, it breaks it down into all the different animals and the different feast days and, you know, your sin offerings and your grain offerings, sin offerings, burnt offerings. But if you just take the big sum total number at the end, since I'm 26, almost 27, if I was under the Old Testament by today, I would have had to offer 34,842 animals by today. Almost 35,000. And I'm just a regular Israelite. I'm not the priest who's offering sins for myself and for all of the people. That's a lot of sacrifices. And then I had to wonder, have I offered that many spiritual sacrifices in my 27 years? That's a lot of sacrifices. One last verse. Let's turn to Hebrews chapter 9. There are a lot of good verses in Hebrews that we could go to, but I'd like to look at two in Hebrews chapter 9, verses 11 and 12. But when Christ appeared as a high priest of the good things to come, he entered through the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is to say, not of this creation. And not through the blood of goats and calves, but through his own blood he entered the holy place, once for all, having obtained eternal redemption. Just as under the Old Testament, the high priests would go in and offer sacrifices for the people, Christ is our high priest, and he made a sacrifice one time that would cover all of my sins so that I don't have to offer 34,842 animals to try to atone for my sins. And not only did he offer up that sacrifice, but just as the high priest would then proceed to go into the most holy place, Jesus also went into the most holy place after offering that sacrifice. And we're told here that it's not the earthly tabernacle, not the physical holy place that we were talking about before, but the most holy place being up in heaven in God's presence. And there's one thing, one quote that I really like, or one saying from Justin Dobbs that he likes to say is, to go where Jesus went, you need to do what Jesus did. And I think that applies here. To go where Jesus went, to be able to go into the most holy place as he did after offering that sacrifice, we need to do what he did. We need to offer ourselves as spiritual sacrifices, as we read in Romans. I hope this lesson has helped you to understand exactly what holiness is. And when God says, be holy as I am holy, he's expecting us to be set apart from all of the other people in the world. As Christians, we don't have the gold plate on the front of our head that we walk around every day that says, holy to the Lord. And we don't have special garments